to see you, Katie. How are you?
So good to see you. I have my nice radio voice,
Oh,
so
I
bear
can
with us,
tell.
listeners.
Yeah. You're getting over something, huh?
I got a cold. Yeah, that rest day, I need to implement that rest day we talked about a few episodes ago. I think that could have prevented this.
Yeah, maybe. Colds are going around. Well, everyone, thanks for joining us. This is Sports Drinks, and we're here with a new episode. I am Tiffany Brown,
And I am Katie Steele.
and we're excited to talk about all the things today. How have you been, Katie? Besides the
I've been,
sickness.
yeah, the little cold. I've been doing well. I actually, so listeners, yesterday I got off the, I'll give, we talked on this in episode one, but I'll give a little high level in terms of history, just in case you didn't hear that episode. But I ran in college at U of O and then transferred to Florida State. But while U of O got connected with Alberto Salazar, who had connected me with Dr. Brown, who was an endocrinologist in Texas. And, they were, Alberto was unofficially at Oregon coaching while I was there. And there had been a couple coaching changes. And I was just like, broken little bird. I was sad and depleted and vulnerable. And it felt like he just kind of swooped in like the superhero and kind of got me up off the floor and gave me some hope with some of these things, like referring me to Dr. Brown. And you're 20 at the time. And it ended up unfolding in such a way that I didn't even know until I was 28. When I sat in a fertility doctor's office and he told me I had been treated for a thyroid condition that I never had. And during that time, Dr. Brown had given me this diagnosis. He and Alberto would continue to like modify my or adjust my medication, draw my blood, things of that nature. And truly, the reason I share this and why this is a very lengthy check-in, but it feels important, is it was the catalyst for a lot of the work that we're doing here, including this podcast of I got a call, then I get my blood drawn all the time because my doctor has tried to take me off of the thyroid medication. They can't do it because my body's become reliant on it. And now I have to get my blood work done all the time. I've had multiple medical things, including fertility treatment, things with my endocrine system, my autoimmune system, my cycles. And every time it comes back to this kind of confusion around my health history and things that I don't know. And yesterday, when I got a call that things are kind of out of whack again, I texted Tiffany immediately and I said, I mean, keep in mind, y'all, this was like 15, 20 years ago. It wasn't a minute ago. This isn't new news. This isn't my first rodeo. This isn't the first barrier or time in which I've needed to make some type of adjustment or have faced some kind of health need. And I texted Tiffany and I said, this, if we need a motivator, this is another one because the sole reason for these projects is the impact, the lifelong impact, the long-standing impact that coaches and doctors and athletic systems have on athletes, right? Choices that are made in the minute for sport. That door doesn't just shut when the athlete steps away from sport. And I live it. And it's really, really unfortunate. And my biggest thing is it's 100% preventable. That my experience was 100% preventable.
I think the well, let's back up just to get into some of the details that people maybe don't know. So you were a runner at University of Oregon. You were, like you said, this, I mean, I don't like to see you as a broken bird, but I'm gonna let you use your words for that. You're feeling like a broken bird. Alberto Salazar came along. For many of you who maybe aren't major track and field followers, Alberto Salazar is a infamous kind of coach and figure within USA Track and Field, and it's worth looking up and doing a Google search to read all of the awful things that he has done over time. It's not debatable that he had a significant amount of power and abuse over multiple athletes. So that's another fact. The other thing here that I think is important, if people don't know this about you, is he came along, as you were saying, and said, let me help you. I want to support you. I want to invest in you and your career. And that meant, you know, how good that feels to anyone who's, you know, feeling kind of broken and out of sorts and wants to compete and wants to do the thing they've been dreaming of for so long. That's a lifeline. And he took you under his wing. And what actually happened is, I think the most devastating part of the story, besides the impact that it's had on you lifelong. And just to put it bluntly, he worked with a medical doctor. This person's name is Dr. Brown. That's not me. And that's not anybody I'm related to. That always feels like important for me to say out there, even though no one probably cares. One of those common name things, you know, and he worked with Dr. Brown to give you thyroid medication and tell you that you had a thyroid issue. And from there, that meant that you were able to have access to thyroid medication, which was performance enhancing and not banned if it was attached to a diagnosis. Am I tracking all that? Correct. Yeah. You all can't see Katie shaking her head. Yes, yes, yes. I say all of it so like bluntly, because I think in most situations where there's such significant trauma, it's beyond convoluted, because the convoluted aspect of it is what allows the perpetrator to continue, because it creates such a firestorm that doesn't necessarily all add up or make sense. And then it allows them to continue doing what they're doing. Oh, Katie. So another chapter in the conversation of getting information from a current medical doctor saying, oh yeah, here's the newest information and chapter of what the impact of that was over time.
Mm-hmm. And you think it goes away, right? And I think the part that, you know, being on the other side of writing The Price She Pays and talking with so many girls and so many women of this sharedness and this notion of I'm the problem and I did something wrong and what is wrong with me? And wanting to bring voice to the fact that it's nothing. Right? Like you mm-hmm. are not the problem. Last night, I even pulled up my medical records, and I do this now having retrieved them from this book writing process. And I fact checked, because my first initial response is, what is wrong with me? Is this real? Am I blowing this out of proportion? Why do I have a reaction? This doesn't even make any sense. And it doesn't make any sense. And the thing that can anchor me is rooting in the facts of this really did happen. This isn't something that you're blowing out of proportion or being a martyr or being a victim, which is the language we heard women use all the time that they didn't want to be perceived as, which I relate to wholeheartedly, because we take it on as though it's ours. And looking at the medical records, it can anchor me in the fact of like, no, this is really messed up. This is really messed up that I don't know my health history and I continually have to be adjusting it and assessing it and modifying it, and it's out of my control. And I now have to integrate this medication and the symptoms and responses of it, because these men gave it to me unnecessarily for their own benefits without, and this is a really important piece, without including me in that process, right? And I think about, I mean, this would be still so wrong for all of the ways I described myself earlier in this conversation at that time, with that like broken bird, vulnerable, depleted, everything was kind of at this like quote unquote rock bottom. It still would have been exploiting to have them ask me that, because I wasn't in a space to be able to make reasonable decisions. However, at least they would have gotten some type of verbal consent. And I never agreed to do this. They did it all without my consent.
Like the idea of, would you take this medication? Yeah. Yeah.
And maybe I would have, honestly, like I loved running. I was obviously very desperate to be well and to compete and to perform. I wanted that so badly that I hope I wouldn't have said yes, but maybe I would have. And I would at least now in this moment be able to say, that's a choice you made and you have to you have to do that work now, instead of like, I didn't even know that was happening. I didn't even know that they were changing the chemistry of my body and what that was going to mean long-term.
Well, and I think what is, you know, changing the chemistry of your body because they were drugging you.
Correct.
And I think that's the part that is, you know, to be blunt. And I know that you are, give me permission to be blunt about this, but I think, and, you know, an outsider looking in, and, you know, you hear things such as medication and you were given a med, and it sounds like, oh, someone's really working to kind of help you stay in it and help you stay compete. That is not what happened. The medication is actually a drug you did not have a diagnosis for. They gave you a diagnosis incorrectly, which is fraudulent and abusive in terms of all the ways that that is not okay and wrong. And then you were on that medication for a significant amount of time, still on, because you can't go off of it now because of how it changed the chemistry of your body. They drugged you, and drugged you in such a way that you have to continue drugging yourself to have any type of baseline in terms of your body.
Yep. Yeah. Like, and there were like major effects even at the time. If they were tampering with dosages that I was passing out because they got my levels so low. In the documentation, and this was one of the ones that I read last night, that still, when I read it, I like reread it and I'm like, oh my gosh, like what? And you are so vulnerable. You don't even see it for what it is at the time, but I passed out while driving because my dosage was so low. And then my levels plummeted. And then I passed out in my room, and my roommate had to take me into the doctor because she found me passed out. Like, that is not okay. Right. No. For their own like experiment. And so I guess I'm like reconnecting with why we're doing what we're doing, because we have to create systems and protocols and agreements within athletic systems to preserve athlete well-being, so that when they leave sport or when they choose to step away from sport, one, it's not because of coach abuse, and two, they don't have to do trauma treatment. They don't have to continually try to learn more about themselves and piece together this puzzle that somebody manipulated and just like took all the pieces and threw them all over the world for them to have to try to put back together.
If you don't, I'm naming this again for our listeners. If you don't know much about the Salazar story, he has now been banned from USA track and field. And for, you know, a large list of egregious behaviors and abusive actions. Right before we got on here to record, knowing that we were going to talk about this today, Katie and I were, you know, for those of you that know a lot about the Nassar case related to USA Gymnastics, you know, he's in that category. And I don't know that you can really put monsters up against monsters. I think that's a really high, that's a high bar to try to decide who's worse in any of those situations, because they're all absolutely, there's not even words that I feel like I can put together that would make any sense for the mistreatment and the abuse and the trauma and the power. And I think it had, like, saying that also, I want people to know, if you're not familiar with the story, that's what we're talking about. A long list of athletes who, in ways that are hard to understand and that none of you have any answers to. I think that's the part that, you know, when you're looking at trauma that is this deep and insignificant, and this mistreatment is categorically kind of maniacal, it is, there's not clarity as to why. There's not a good answer to why. And I think you've hypothesized a little bit over time, as to, you know, was it to get you in a particular type of shape to compete, or was it to use you as a test subject to get levels and, you know, tinkering with formulas for other elite athletes? And so I'm wondering, just as we're talking about this now, like, what are your thoughts about that? And I know you talk about it a little bit in the book, so you don't have to maybe say everything now, but I'm just curious, like, how that sits with you, knowing that you were a part of a larger plan, even though we don't get to know the plan.
Mm-hmm. I for sure think it was a part of a larger plan. And quite frankly, I don't think it was, I never went on to, quite frankly, compete again after getting connected with them. And so, but yet they stayed deeply connected to my care and to me. And one of the ways that I've shared the story with Tiffany, but they became like friendly with my parents, like to the point where Alberto would call my parents, and they, Dr. Brown, before the 08 trials, needed a ride from the airport. And Alberto called my parents to see if they could pick him up because he was tied up with something else, right? Of like the level of corruption and manipulation is very, very deep. And I never, I didn't have anything. Maybe there was like a small chance or twinkle in a star that if that would have come to fruition, that my performance would have gained from it. But this is what fuels my passion for this topic, is like, you can't just focus on performance without taking care of the soul of a person. And my soul was so depleted that there was not a chance that I was going to be able to perform in that state emotionally. So I really do believe that it was for this greater, lack of a better word, experiment. And through the people I've met in the process of other gals who were not at the caliber of this like Olympic status, they also were sent. Like there are, there, I am not the only one who was being used in this process. And that's the scary part, right? I don't know the depths of it, but I know it's very, very deep. And we all only know the scratch. I believe we all only know the scratch of the surface, myself included, having done tons of research into my own history that I'm piecing together from other doctors' documentation.
Listeners, I think we skipped over this in the beginning because we felt so strongly to get into this conversation, but today we're, this is our par for the course. And this act of, coaches and people in power doing what is best for them, or what they see as being the catalyst for their own careers, and completely disregarding the health and well-being of athletes. And, here on Sports Shrinks, we really focus on the par for the course each week, knowing that there are so many stories out in the world where, we pass them back and forth to each other all week long, saying, oh my gosh, here's another story. And here's another one. And here's another one of where athletes are discarded in some way, or, into the, the depths of, gender discrimination, or, issues of, like we talked about the Nike uniforms a couple of weeks ago. So it's important to us to be having these conversations to bring them really into the light of the things that we know are just so a part of the pattern and fabric of sports. And I think this one is particularly, sensitive, meaningful, given that it's your story. And, Katie, you've given a lot of time and attention to your own healing and recovery, and then also the research that has allowed you to be in this conversation that led us to writing our book. And so I appreciate your willingness to put it on the table. And I wonder, from your perspective, what is the par here? Like, what's the par for the course in your story that feels so meaningful to you, to be, for us to continue to talk about it in such a way that, again, sheds light on, such a meaningful yet destructive part of your story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The first thought that pops into my mind is, our very first proposal we were writing, we did that weekend at your house in Eugene, and Tiffany and I were putting together all of our thoughts and creating kind of the flow of what the book was going to be. And you made a comment and you said something along the lines that it was for sure more articulate than this, but a version of, wow, well, your story is impactful. The fact that your story is not unique is the story. And that is the story, right? And that's the story we've told through the price she pays, is that it isn't unique and it is impactful. I'm not saying this in like a minimizing way at all. I'm saying it in, this is the par for the course, right? Mm-hmm. There are a dime a dozen athletes who are used or abused or mistreated for the gain of the sport or the system or the coach at the expense of their own well-being. Mm-hmm. That's the par for the course. We've heard countless stories. We continue to hear countless stories. I did a presentation. I've done two presentations in the last week, one very large, one smaller. And the amount of stories of people that came up to me afterward and said, my kid or myself or my athletes was, I can't even count them, right? Like, mm-hmm. it's so sad. People are suffering at the expense of getting results. And I mean, you know this about me, like to my bones, I love results. I love outcomes. I love drive. I love sport for that reason. I love expectations. So this isn't at all about dampening that, but rather where was it ever constructed within the sport system that it had to be either or? Mm-hmm. Right? That we, that coaches could go away with the way in which they treat athletes in the name of sport. And you've said this, and I think could be a good conversation for any of the listeners of, if that were happening clinically with parents, with other adults, that would be a pause, mm-hmm. right? And yet as a sports system, we just blow right by it. Because it's sports and they're coaches and they can do these types of things without any, literally any type of pause.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. When we were talking about that before, the idea that if I'm in a clinical setting and I'm sitting with, you know, perhaps a family and an adult says to a young person, you know, curses at them to get them to do something, or, you know, the mistreatment that we hear all the time about, that happens to athletes. Yeah. It's a pause in therapy. It's a, whoa, whoa, whoa. We've got to have one, a larger conversation to assess the safety within the system and the family and what needs to happen from there. It's also safety planning to ensure the well-being of, those in the system that can't protect themselves. So minors, for one, and then looking at specifically what's happening to perpetuate this abuse, because it has to stop. And, you know, these are things that are just so categorically, I mean, it's what we do in clinical work all the time. Like, I don't even have to really think about it because those are just so much what we do. And yet in the world of sport, it becomes, so accepted. It's that you're right. That is the par for the course. I mean, this conversation, I think, is, you know, I think every time we talk about it, and we've, you know, this is the second time we've talked about it on air, and I know that it's in the book. And so the story is, you know, we're getting it out there in many ways, but I find myself, the therapist in me is somehow locked far, far away, because the friend in me who cares about you has such a visceral response, and I get rageful. Like that's what I have access to the most when we talk about it. It's, I know that, you know, the therapeutic response is empathy and compassion, and, you know, which I know you feel for me. So I know I don't have to prove that, but every time we get into it, I just in my full body feel rage, to the point where right before this, y'all, I said to Katie, like, oh, I just want to punch him right in the face. How long would I have to serve time? What would actually happen?
And I told her, don't do it. I need you. Don't do it.
And, you know, but it has, which is funny because we're talking about like, don't be mistreating people. And then that's, you know, that's my response, but that's, you know, we can unpack that at a different time. But that my protection of you, or my protectiveness of you as a friend, and also just quite frankly, any athlete who doesn't have control, because they are in a position of lesser power. And we know that when we're talking about middle school, high school, college, elite, there's always a larger system above them that's benefiting from what they're doing. You know, for middle schoolers and high schoolers, it's oftentimes a coach or a school, someone's like coaching record, or, you know, for or their own reputation. And then we move up the ladder in terms of elite sports, and it's oftentimes adding, you know, larger universities, athletic departments, athletic sponsors. Directors, and then sponsors. And then we're talking about brands that are, you know, deeply, deeply in the pockets of all of these systems, that becomes the focus, not the athlete. And I think what's tough is I know that we could be in that conversation with so many people and they'd be like, oh yeah, that's such a mess. And yet we go right back in and we do what we do. We don't pause enough to recognize what a corrupt system we have in terms of sports. And you're right. It's hard because we love sport. It's not like we critique it. And because we love it, you're going to find us in the bleachers and in the stands of track meets and basketball and hockey. And, you know, these are the things we love to do. And yet, because we love it so much, we know there's so many problems and we don't want kids to stop playing. I'm noticing we do this where I know we could talk about Salazar and his impact for at least a couple more hours, but we'll go ahead and pause right there. I do want to say, you know, thank you, Katie, for just kind of sharing that. And I know it was kind of your check-in, but it really is our par for the course for the week and really speaks to how important it is to pay attention to what athletes say and what their stories are. And, we unpack all of this in our new book that's coming out in June called The Price She Pays. Yes, that is a shameless plug, but I also think if this is remotely interesting to you, that is the place to kind of dig in more, because we really pull back the curtain on what happens across sport. It really is not so much about a single athlete or a single team. We interviewed hundreds of women and specifically look at the impact on women. So thanks for checking in about that.
Absolutely. And I think the thing that's so important about that is to echo your point that we do love sport. And if we didn't believe it was possible to generate a meaningful change, we would not have taken on this project. We would not be doing this work. Mm-hmm. And in the book, we have tons of solutions, right? It's yes, true. We are identifying a problem and we are also providing solutions because they are there. They are there. When I say a lot of this is preventable, it really is. It really is preventable. And that's what gives us so much hope, that we can structure and create systems and give coaches the tools they need to create programs with athlete well-being front and center.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, let's, as we do here, make a really awkward left turn into, to keep this train a moving. As a reminder to everyone, you can send us in some questions. And this week we have a question from Sheila. But let me just kind of highlight how you can send things to us. And so at any point that you have a question or something you want us to talk about here on Sports Shrinks, get on a voice memo and send us a quick reporting. Tell us who you are, where you're located, and let us know what your question is. And so Sheila submitted hers, and we're pairing it with this conversation because it's so interconnected. And so as we get into the listener question, I think it's important to just highlight that nothing is a single answer. We keep getting into, the interconnectedness of where we need to intervene in terms of with coaches, with parents, with athletic systems. Not one area is going to be the change that, changes the entire thing. So you and I are going to keep at it and, hit all the areas as best as we can. No problem. We got it. Easy. Okay. Well, let's listen to the question from Sheila this week. And I think she's calling from somewhere on the East Coast. So let's hear from Sheila.
Hi, Sports Shrinks. This is Sheila from Philadelphia. Can you help me understand what mental health integration actually means in sports?
Hey, Sheila from Philadelphia. That I think the question is timely. I think it's a big question. How does mental health integrate into sports? I'm giggling because I want to unpack that in a 10-minute discussion that I think we need forever and ever to discuss. So, but it's the very question that we need to be talking about, especially after everything you shared today, Katie. So, first thoughts about what Sheila's asking about. What do you think?
Well, Sheila, I am so grateful for the question because, and this, listeners in general, Tiffany and I can get like, we geek out on this and we like love this content to our bones. And so we can throw out things like mental health integration into sport. And like, it's like saying, do you want peanut butter and jelly? And just everybody's going to know that. And indeed, yes, that is the question, right? And my apologies for not breaking that down sooner. And we'll make sure we're kind of breaking down these concepts and ideas along the way in a better way. So thank you for holding us accountable. Mm-hmm. Because it's a big lift, and we use it kind of broadly, and to Tiffany's point, in a lot of different ways. But what we know is that when we can consider athletes' mental health, we can get better outcomes, right? So then it asks the question of what does that mean and how does that look? And we like to start simple, right? We don't, in contradiction with us just using the terminology broadly, basic steps and basic interventions. So what does that mean when we say attunement and we want coaches to be paying attention and noticing what an athlete is feeling, and that both parties are leaving the conversation feeling connected and heard and valued? We want to break down those concepts to give people tangible tools so that it isn't just a huge systemic shakeup. Well, we'd love that, making sure that there's clear intervention so that athletes' well-being is considered when making athletic decisions.
And I think we would even venture to say our goal would be that it's prioritized. We're just at such a, you know, we're working backwards here to get people to even buy into the conversation that, you know, considered is the baseline, I think, with where we're at now. Yeah, I think the, you know, part of this, and maybe, you know, maybe this is assumed already by the people who listen to our podcast, you know, you got to have some buy-in, I guess, to considering well-being and mental health and sports to tune into us. But I think there's a premise here that's really important around you and I, and I'm assuming our listeners have experienced, witnessed, heard stories of people where their well-being was not considered. And I mean, as evidenced by the start of today's episode and what you were saying, that's the egregious story. The Nassar story is egregious. And, you know, so yes, we care about that. And we're working to infiltrate systems in such a way where folks who are in it for themselves and are abusive and mistreating athletes immediately go. Like, there's no room for them. They're not allowed. At the same time, we know that there are so many kids, yes, young people, all the way through elite athletes who are abused and mistreated in a way that is sometimes not as obvious. It's not as egregious. And we story it as it being, my God, that's just sports. That's just what happens. You got to get tough on athletes. And we do not recognize the depth of the impact that people in power have in those scenarios, whether it be a coach that is someone's, you know, parent who's volunteering their time on the weekends for, you know, seventh grade travel basketball, or to elite coaches who have dedicated their lives themselves to what they're doing. And so I think, you know, when we talk about this integration, I love that you said, Katie, the idea that it's, you know, tangible small tools, because it is sometimes the smallest tool of kind of caring about the athlete, and not just like, oh, of course I care about them. Why wouldn't do this if I didn't care about them? We mean in conversation, helping an athlete feel seen and heard, that when they say they're tired and overwhelmed and they don't know if they can push through it, that you believe them and you sit in that with them and talk with them about you know, making some decisions versus getting in their face and cursing them out and telling them they need to get their shit together. Like, I think that the bar is so low in terms of good coach athlete or systems and athlete conversations that the things that you and I come up with feel so teeny tiny, but we also know how dramatic of a difference it would make for athletes.
Totally. And we know it's not prioritized at all, right? Like, to give an example, we scoured coaches' contracts, college coaches, right? Because they're oftentimes the ones with a contract. So scoured coaches' contracts. And it was like, if you looked at the breakdown of how they were incentivized, it was very, very clear based off outcome. You'd get this bonus for this, you'll get this bonus for that, you'll get contract extension for this, right? That was very clear based on outcome, based on performance, championships, things of that nature. And then the contracts, because most people are savvy enough to know it needs to be considered, there'd be a line of athlete well-being will be considered. So what we need to see is we need to see, again, outcome, sure, keep all that other stuff. We need to see that much due diligence in terms of accountability for athlete well-being integrated into the athletic system. So that meaning things like, what is the coach's retention rate? What is their injury rate? What is the report by athletes? How many student athletes are donating to the program after they leave because they had such a positive experience? We need to make some of the tangibles linked back to the accountability for coaches, because right now there is no system. Coaches really, it is a, and there, I do want to give the caveat of like, there are some really incredible coaches out there. So I don't want you all to think we're missing that. We see you, we know how hard the job is. There it is, hours, and so much is asked of you all. And those coaches would then reap the benefit because they're considering how the athlete is doing and how their program is actually, are results being cultivated out of fear? Are results being cultivated out of athletes feeling the sense of belonging and belief in themselves and getting result, long-standing results, not just a short-term instant gratification out of fear, this fear tactic. And so we want to see it integrated in the interactions that coaches or parents are having with athletes directly. And we want to see it integrated into contracts and policy, because we know the NCAA has a trickle-down effect into youth sports, right? This isn't a siloed approach. So when we talk about mental health integration, we are looking at it from that full spectrum.
And let's be super clear. NCAA has talked about how they care about mental health. And yet, you know, I was just in my head just went, and the proof is in the pudding. I don't know how old that saying is, but it's true. There's recommendations for collegiate institutions. There are recommendations to be considering mental health. They're not requirements. Programs are not held to a standard of expectation. And in fact, during the March Madness in both the men's and women's tournament, I don't know if you caught this, there was an NCAA commercial that kept going in almost like every game. I feel like I was hearing this, and I should have recorded the exact or written down the exact words, but it was a commercial for NCAA and all these great things NCAA is doing. And then it said something like, and mental health, or we're adding or we're bringing or something, mental health resources or mental health something. And I sat there each and every time. And I mean, those of you that know me can know that I would do this, but like yelling at my TV, literally going, show us, like, what are you saying? You can't just say it. You have to do it. And we're in this work all the time. There's no extras. There's nothing that's changed. There's no resources that are coming through or requirements for coaches or new things that are being presented. It's all lip service. And, you know, so when we're talking about integration, you know, we're talking about expectations. We're talking about measurement of success. You know, yes, records and winning championships, great. Like, go for it. Go win. Go do all the cool things that sport does. And like you were saying, What is the experience of the athlete? What does it take to get there? Are you abusive to the athletes on the team? Are you supportive of them? And not supportive in a passive way, but in a, I'm invested in you. You are bigger than sport. We are all bigger than sport. What we need is more important. And I think the thing that I keep coming back to is when we were doing interviews for the book, we asked so many times, you know, what do you think, you know, it takes? Like what would be a difference in your experience? And granted, our subset was people who wanted to tell the stories of how they were mistreated and what had occurred. And when asked, what would make a difference? You know, what would you like to see moving forward? We heard things like respect, that they actually care about me, that I matter. Like, we're not talking, these are not brain science. We got to get in a lab and figure out how to put these things into practice. We're talking general basic principles. And y'all that are listening, this is, you might be thinking like, oh, I know coaches do that. They do not. There are so many teams, so many athletes that we have talked to where they never felt respected by their coach or coaching staff. They never felt seen by them. Multiple athletes that said when they were injured, their coach never talked to them. Literally, like that is not an exaggeration. I mean that in the most literal form. They didn't talk to the athlete. Why? Because the athlete can't do anything for the team right now. They're injured. They're sidelined. And I think these are those stories that, you know, we hear them and we know that they're problematic and we know that it's not okay. But then we don't realize how that type of behavior and what we are permissible or what is permissible does trickle down to youth sports. And that's, I know you know a lot about that in terms of your kids, but I'm thinking like what coaches say to kids, what is, and I know I'm realizing as I'm saying all this, we're naming all the problems versus like what integration actually is, because what I feel like so much, and I'm noticing this as I'm talking, is sometimes I feel like we have to prove that there's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so frustrating.
Totally. Totally. Yep. Yep. And everything you're saying brings it full circle right back to the impact, right? Of all of those things you listed, that impact on that human being is significant. And so if we think about solutions, things like curiosity, we talked about this last week, right? Of just wondering and taking the time. We talked about cats, right? Of like, what do people like? So some of the time, and I love what you're naming because it's true. It feels like this, like, prove it. And I have felt that as an athlete. I proved it to myself last night by looking at my medical records. Prove it that that's actually a problem. Prove it that that actually happened. I pulled up my lab work and sure enough, I had to prove it. Right. And I think that's the problem. And that is the burden that athletes are having to carry. And so what we want to do is we want to be able to alleviate them from having to carry that burden by feeling seen, by feeling a place of belonging, by being believed. Mm-hmm. Right. And so curiosity and inquisitiveness and attunement, those are the solutions.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right. And there's others, right? Like we can get into the more of the systemic, but if we take it down to the finite of what a human has control over, right? Literally right now, they could implement it today. I want to integrate mental health into my program today. Get curious about your athletes, learn who they are, learn what their goals are and how you can support them.
Mm-hmm.
That is mental health integration.
Mm-hmm. And it's the things to not do. Don't yell. Don't scream at your athletes. Don't curse in their faces. Don't bench them because they did one thing wrong and you're trying to teach them a lesson. Like it's the games and the tactics that are problematic. So it's just as much of doing new things as it is extinguishing particular behaviors. And I think when I consider some of the other suggestions that, and I know we outline a lot of this in the book, wow, this is a true, like, read our book episode.
Read our book.
We both are so, like, we do not want to be these people. And I'm realizing as we're talking, like, we've become these people. Our publicist, Chris, would be just so proud of us right now. But, you know, part of it is not assuming that sport is going to be the solve for the mental health issues that maybe someone is already navigating. So if someone has depression or they have anxiety, it is not push through it and go compete. You know, sometimes it's about, and that's what you're saying about believing, understanding, be curious. What is the impact of that anxiety right now? Do you need to kind of take a break? The times that we heard people talk about, and we know they're out there, and there's a lot of them, of when it went really, really well, was I'm remembering one story of a soccer player on the East Coast at a D1 school who was really struggling with her mental health. She was struggling with a lot of belonging as a woman of color. And her coach like just showed up and talked with her about, what do you need? And that, I remember her saying, that was the question. What do you need? And she said, I need to go home for a while. I need to get back to my people. I need to like go take care of myself. And coach said, okay, let's figure out how to make that happen. And allowed her to go home. I think she even said she did some workouts or some training at home. And I don't think she was gone for that long. I think in the conversation with her, she shared with us, it was like a week or a week and a half or something. And so she went and got what she needed and came back to the team. And then he fully brought her into the fold with the team. It's small stuff like that. And yes, that might have big impact. Maybe it goes against some of, you know, for some coaches, they're, you know, oh, I can't, like, that's going to mess with team dynamics. It's also messing with team dynamics to assume that someone can push through all that. And we're not talking someone being like, oh, I'm tired, coach. I don't want to practice. Can I go home? Yeah, go home because I care about mental health. We're talking about like, you know, you're so connected to your athletes. You know, the difference between, you know, just being tired one day and like having a hard time and needing to just check in and spend some time with them versus someone's met this maxed burnout where they need another level of intervention to support them and to fill back their cup.
Alleviate the pressure, what I hear you saying, to alleviate the pressure from parents or coaches, you do not need to be a mental health first responder. You are oftentimes in that role. You do not need to become a trained clinician. What Tiffany just conveyed was each human is the expert of themselves. If you ask the person, the athlete in this situation, what they need, they will know. Ask them the question and let them guide it. You don't have to have the answers. Yeah. Alleviate yourself of the pressure of needing to know everything and instead just ask the question, what do you need? How can I support you? And then trust them. You don't need to know. You don't need to do an extra certification. You just have to ask the question.
Well, they don't have to do an extra certification until we start offering those. And then yes,
I mean, we'll come on. And that. I would love an extra certification, but I'm just saying for simplicity's sake, please do the certification when it comes about, but like, just ask, right? Like this isn't actually adding more to your plate. And this is the conversation I feel like we have all the time. It's like, you will save yourself on the back end if you can do a little bit up front. Mm-hmm. Do a little bit up front, you save yourself exponentially. Mm-hmm. So Sheila, thank you for the question.
Yeah, thanks. I want to end on a positive, because what Sheila brought in was, I think, this banter and all of our feelings, and there's a lot of, so shout out to Sheila again, thank you, especially calling from Philadelphia. We'll see if now we know that Pennsylvania is on the map. But I want to end with an example, given all the things we're talking about, and we often do name all the really, the hardships and the things that we notice that are wrong. And I was at my niece's track meet this week, and she's a thrower for the first time. And, you know, their coach really likes them to do three events. So she does all three throwing events. And she's never done track before. She's a senior in high school. I think I mentioned that maybe a couple episodes ago. But I was observing this week in her discus, which is her strongest event. She's just like PRing after PRing each week, which is pretty, you know, there's something about that being pretty typical when you're new. You don't plateau as much, but she's also not getting PRs in the other events that she's having, or she has not as often, I guess is what I'm trying to say. All that to say, that's the setup. I watched her warm up. I watched her, you know, in these conversations with her coach. The coach is positive, encouraging, giving her tactics in terms of, you know, do more of this, keep doing that thing you're doing in terms of how she was warming up and moving her body, very specific coaching ideas and strategies. You know, there was such a calmness about the coach, such a belief in her athletes. I watched her, you know, talk with the others that were kind of waiting to go, that were all around the discus area. And I watched it with such awe and appreciation. One, because I knew that my niece was benefiting from it. So there's definitely like a personal, like, okay, I'm so glad this is what's happening, and that she has this woman who's so invested in her and all of these athletes. So that check, that feels really good. Second, what I watched happen was so much love for her athletes, and just, you know, she's palling around with them, and she's, you know, while she's also giving really good coaching, to the point where my niece had a huge PR this week, which it wouldn't matter if she did or didn't. Like, that's besides the point, quite frankly. And what the coach is doing is working, and was able to see Jocelyn just have an incredible throw. She knew it right when she threw it that it was a PR. She even yelled out, and I to the coach or to me, I don't know, but that was a PR. And you know, she was so excited. And it was like that coach is getting good results and is being so kind and you know, boundaried even with her kids. Like, she was, you know, she had to keep them in line. It's hard to corral a bunch of high schoolers, you know? And I just watched this whole thing going, that's it. That's the whole thing. That's it. And as simple as it is, that's what we're saying, everybody, that we want to see over and over and over again. And I wish I knew her name and I would shout her out right here. But the throws coach at Rosebrook High School is just, I think, embodies the thing that we're really hoping for, and for everybody, because we know that it works.
Bravo to that coach. Be that coach. Be that type of parent.
Be that coach.
The impact will be significant.
Significant. Yeah. All right. Thank you all for being here. Let me give you the rundown of things where you can find us. We did mention our book, The Price She Pays. It's available for pre-order. It comes out on June 18th. You can pre-order it wherever you buy books. You can go to our website, which is athletesmentalhealthfoundation.org, and we do have some links to pre-order if you would like. Also, check out our resources. We've got some online trainings for you, lots of things to help you do all the things that we're talking about across the episodes of Sports Shrinks. And if you really like just kind of day-to-day content, you can find us on Instagram at Athletes Mental Health Foundation. And that wraps up our episode. Thank you, everybody, for being here. Thank you, Katie, for just your candor and vulnerability today and kicking us off with another chapter of your story. And I'm sure we will keep unpacking that in episodes to come.
Aw, thank you. Appreciate you all.